With the highest number of young STEM graduates per capita in the EU, Ireland has the people and skills your company needs to succeed here. IDA Ireland, the National Investment Development Agency, can help you find and nurture the people you need to internationalise and thrive. Our talent is just one of the extraordinary benefits Ireland has to offer. Learn more at idaireland.com. Invest in extraordinary.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Aura Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Only through the most fearless and intrepid reporting did our correspondent discover a valuable economics lesson in modern-day America. We find the intersection of industry consolidation and price discrimination on the country's ski slopes.
And many of the world's biggest museums have more items in their basements than they do on display. The British Museum only actually exhibits 1% of what it's got. Our correspondent looks at plans to change that. First up, though,
so in November 2022, discontent was brewing in China. People had endured 2 years of pandemic restrictions, and there'd been these huge lockdowns in giant cities where millions of people were kept home.
Rosie Bloor is an international China correspondent for The Economist.
There was a particular incident, a fire in an apartment building in Urumqi in Xinjiang, which provoked widespread protests across the country, more than anything anyone had seen in decades. These were not huge protests, but they were in lots of places, and people came out onto the streets with white squares of paper to represent the idea that they just couldn't speak. And for a lot of people, the way they tracked what was happening was by following a particular account on Twitter, now X, where one person was reposting videos and photos of protests happening back in his home country. And that person was Li Ying, who was a master's student in Milan. So since then, he's accumulated 1.6 million followers inside China and out, many of them Chinese nationals. And he, just a couple of weeks ago, started warning people in China and outside to unfollow him or take other precautions, like changing their usernames, not using Chinese-made phones. And that's because police have started interrogating his followers. And that points to a growing issue, which is that the tentacles of the Chinese state are reaching ever further into the diaspora.
Tell me a bit more about that. Beyond the case of Mr. Li, what evidence do we have that that's happening?
So the interesting thing is that whatever story you're reporting amongst the Chinese diaspora, you're really reporting this story too. So one person I spoke to for writing about this was a woman in the Netherlands. She wanted to use a pseudonym because she's afraid of voicing her concerns in public. And she's typical of many Chinese who moved to the West in recent years. She's well-educated and she's wealthy. She's not a dissident. She's not an activist. As she put it to me, she left China in search of clean air and untainted food. And yet she is scared of the watchful eyes of the Chinese state. When she left Shanghai in 2012, she kept in touch with friends on WeChat, a Chinese app, but then she realized that some of her messages were being censored. So censorship on WeChat is often quite subtle. You can send a message, you see it as being sent, but the person doesn't receive it. There's essentially a back door in WeChat where all messages are being read. In addition to that, WeChat accounts registered to foreign phones. We know that they are monitored by the Chinese state. And so even without being directly threatened, people like her feel intimidated. And that experience of censoring yourself is hard to convey. It's even harder to quantify, but it's extremely powerful. And to me, that's the Chinese autocracy's most powerful tool at home. And now that's effective abroad as well.
So aside from WeChat, are there other ways for China's government to monitor its citizens abroad?
So there are kind of three overlapping ways that the government monitors its citizens abroad. One is the most obvious one, direct intimidation of potential critics. The second is propaganda aimed at the diaspora, affecting all of their entertainment sources and news sources. And then the third is putting pressure on people to censor themselves when discussing Chinese affairs. And so the ones that grab the headlines are where they target dissidents and activists. In 2023, Safeguard Defenders, which is a human rights group, accused China of setting up over 100 police stations in 53 countries without permission. Ethnic minorities are often targeted. So there have been hundreds of Uyghurs sent back to China on dubious grounds and thousands of them harassed.
Okay, but you also mentioned some less direct methods of control, right?
Right. So one thing is a widespread influence on Chinese language media abroad. You used to find an array of different viewpoints in Chinese language media as you would in any other. But the government has started spending billions of dollars. It started this before, but has massively increased this under Xi Jinping to increase the reach of China's state media. It's also bought other outlets and it's applied financial or coercive levers to influence opinions expressed in nominally independent outfits. And then the most pervasive aspect of this involves WeChat, which is so central to China's social and business life that most diaspora Chinese would use this to stay in touch with family in China or to manage their affairs, manage their money. There are other ways too. So there are 65,000 or so Chinese students abroad who are on Chinese government scholarships, and their families have to repay that money if a recipient of the scholarship engages in an act that damages the national interest. And all of that encourages self-censorship, particularly by those with family in China.
Rosie, what's the goal here for Mr. Xi and the Communist Party?
So when China opened up in the 70s, officials realized that lots of Chinese abroad had become very rich and they were seen as kind of an economic resource. The party later tried to lure back academics and entrepreneurs. And that continues to happen, but there's been a real shift under Xi Jinping. He sees the diaspora very much in a political light. So he's increased the funding and the status of the United Front Work Department, which is in charge of boosting the party's influence amongst the Chinese abroad. And the party hopes that these people will be advocates for China, but they also fear that they could criticize China and they might even infect Chinese at home with the idea of foreign democratic thinking or whatever. So Xi Jinping refers to the 45 million people of Chinese ancestry in the world as sons and daughters of the Chinese nation, and he urges great unity among them.
Now, based on all your reporting, how widespread of a concern is this?
So the number of Chinese abroad has doubled since 1990. It's gone up particularly fast since 2000. There are about 10.5 million Chinese people abroad who once held Chinese citizenship. So only the Indian, Russian, and Mexican diasporas are larger. And the pandemic heightened the desire of many members of the elite to leave. But the stakes are higher. And it seems that these days, no matter how far these people run, they can't escape the eyes of the Communist Party of China.
So, Rosie, what does this all mean for Chinese people living abroad?
I mean, it's tough. You know, most Chinese people living abroad, they're not agents of the Chinese Communist Party. They may never even feel anything to do with it. But there is a fear that they will feel intimidated by it. There's a fear that they will be isolated because they are living in a world where many of them, if they are using Chinese language news sources, are really only hearing the words of the Chinese Communist Party. And there's a fear that they will be the subjects of prejudice and discrimination because of fear that they may be tainted by the Chinese Communist Party. So what this creates is a situation where nowhere is really a safe haven anymore.
Rosie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
With the highest number of young STEM graduates per capita in the EU, Ireland has the people and skills your company needs to succeed here. IDA Ireland, the National Investment Development Agency, can help you find and nurture the people you need to internationalise and thrive. Our talent is just one of the extraordinary benefits Ireland has to offer. Learn more at idaireland.com. Invest in extraordinary.
America's famed Rocky Mountain ski resorts kicked off this year's season with far less snowfall than usual. It took until February for them to get the fresh powder that brings skiers to the slopes and queues to the ski lifts. Consistent, plentiful snowfall used to be make or break for ski resorts' profitability. These days, the books balance in different ways.
A fresh powder day is always an incredible thing if you're a skier, but it used to be a really important thing for the business of skiing, too.
Daniel Knowles is The Economist's Midwest correspondent, but we do let him get out of the region occasionally.
And these days, the business of skiing has changed. The link is less clear-cut. The big thing that has taken over almost a whole industry is season passes.
So why the change? Why is everybody getting these mega passes instead?
So I recently went skiing in Colorado in a place called Breckenridge, which is a couple of hours outside Denver. And I paid $260 for a single day lift ticket. If everybody in the resort were paying that much, well, there'd be nobody there. But the reality is that basically everybody else who was skiing with me had paid a lot less. They had bought one of these season passes.
Is it the cost of a season ticket that's new or the mere existence of a season ticket that's new here?
There have always been season tickets, but they used to be this kind of niche thing for locals. Your season pass in the old days would only cover that ski resort and it'd be quite expensive. And the skiing industry made most of its money from selling daily tickets, which they sold at the counter when you arrived. And it was essentially the same price whether you bought it that day or months in advance. What happened in 2008 was that Vail Mountain Resorts, which is a company that began in Vail, Colorado, a big famous ski resort, launched this thing called the Epic Pass. And the Epic Pass was different in two ways. First, it was very cheap and let you ski not just one resort, but several. And second, you could only buy it before the ski season began. Once the snow started falling and the lift started turning, it went off sale. Skiing as an industry, it was always very dependent on the weather. If it snowed a lot, loads of people would go skiing and everybody made money. But if it didn't snow very much, then ski resorts lost money.
So introducing the pass model that you describe here was a way to make the business more viable.
Essentially, yeah, it was a way of getting skiers to commit to skiing before they knew whether it would be a good snow season or not. And that was very successful. And it means that more people are skiing in America than ever before. And Vail has been doing very well. To find out about it, I went skiing at Breckenridge with one of the managers of a neighboring ski resort, Keystone, which they also own, a guy called Chris Sorensen. And we talked about just how these passes work.
We just completed this summer a 550-acre expansion into the high alpine with a six-pack detachable chairlift, cutting some new tree runs, glading, adding snowmaking, all because of the capital we were able to get because of the passes that we sell. So with that, right?
The reason that Vail are able to make these sort of investments is because they're really dominating the industry now. You know, when they launched the Epic Pass, they had five resorts. They now have 41 resorts. And there's a second pass called the Icon, which was launched in 2018, that covers a pretty large share of all the remaining resorts, and that's run by Alterra Mountain Company. The expansion of these season passes, what they've become at the expense of is competition. You now have essentially a choice of which of these two passes to get.
Shouldn't that lack of a competition make prices higher, not lower?
If Vail had to charge the same price to everybody, then that's what they would do. They would charge higher prices and there'd be fewer skiers on the slopes. But what they've been able to do with these passes is price discrimination, is what economists call it. They can charge different prices to different customers. If you're a guy who's not very organized and you turn up on the day and you want to go skiing, you'll pay, like I did, this huge sum of money. But if you're organized and you buy the season pass, you pay a lot less. They get more skiers and more revenue simultaneously. So one of the things I asked Chris Sorensen about is, you know, what that means for ski resorts, how they manage their demand.
The Epic Pass came out and gave access to multiple resorts. It really changed how people thought about skiing, not only within our company, but also outside of our company. Like, people had to like provide access to more because that's what the guests wanted. That's what people wanted.
One of the things that he unsurprisingly doesn't talk about, but that is a bit unpopular about these passes, is that now that so many people have got a season pass, on those really good days where there's a lot of fresh snow, there's huge crowds. Everybody from miles around comes up to go skiing. If you paid full price for your ticket, it can feel a bit annoying to be stuck in a long chairlift queue. But then this is like so much of modern life in America. You know, you've got to work hard to get the good deal.
So you see in this change in the ski industry something of a microcosm of America then?
Yes, absolutely. I think what Vail and Alterra have done with their Epic and Icon passes is what airlines have been doing with their credit card rewards points and their frequent flyer miles and so on. A lot of American businesses, not just skiing, have consolidated, have got less competitive, but have been able to use price discrimination to get people to be loyal. So you have pricing at different times for different people designed to manage demand. Everything in this country, it feels like you have to have a loyalty program, you have to sign up, you have to get coupons to get the right price. Even Wendy's fast food restaurant recently announced they're going to price burgers at different prices according to how busy the restaurants are. So skiing is like the American economy in general now. It's good deals, fresh tracks for those who work it out, but everybody else is left struggling with moguls.
Daniel, thanks very much for your time. Good luck finding all the deals.
Jason, it's always a pleasure.
Can you go through that way? Mm-hmm. I'll cut around. I thought we'd go to Origins now.
Yeah.
In autumn last year, I paid a visit to the Natural History Museum in London.
Caitlin Talbot writes about culture for The Economist.
I was shown around by Claire Valentine, head of the museum's life sciences collection.
Wow.
Yeah. This building has, I think it's 250,000 jars in here.
She took me underneath the Gothic main hall and into some of the storerooms.
If you were here as a long-term visitor, you might be given swipe access for a little while during your visit, so you can get in through the various doors.
What visitors see throughout the museum is only a tiny fraction of its entire collection. So the museum owns about 80 million objects, and around 40,000 of those you can go and see. And the rest are really consigned to places like the basement.
That is the mammal tower, that horrible grey monstrosity. So that literally just contains what we refer to as small mammals.
So down here, there is lots of jumbled furniture, dark wood, storage shelves and drawers, hundreds of jars of giant fish, and a tortoise that was once owned by Charles Darwin and that was actually lost in the collections for a very long time.
New. Somewhere in the collection was Darwin's pet tortoise. Hadn't been able to find it. And
it might sound surprising that something can go missing, but there's so many objects that it can be quite impossible to organise. So
we have known, one, that we've outgrown the space, and two, that we needed better facilities for parts of our collection for a long time.
Despite the museum's best efforts, some parts of the basement are pretty chaotic. There's these very low-ceilinged rooms with small staircases that are just totally packed with cabinets and cabinets and boxes. They're not very usable, and it's also hard to access the things that are at the back, which are at risk of being forgotten. But the Natural History Museum is not unique at all in this. The British Museum exhibits 1% of its treasures. The Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, just 0.007%, so a tiny, tiny, tiny amount is ever on view. In storage, treasures are usually protected. but the old vaults are getting dangerously full.
So what can museums do about the problem of filling up their storage?
One solution is to move house. The Natural History Museum is undertaking the world's biggest relocation of any collection, so 28 million objects are being shifted to a new centre in Reading, west of London. And if you think packing up crockery or old photographs when moving house is tricky, imagine what it's like trying to move delicate, really old taxidermy.
So what will happen to the mammal tower? Will that
eventually that will get knocked down and kind of beyond?
So bears, giraffes, lions, of which the museum has lots, require bespoke fiberglass moulds to protect their very delicate fur, which can break if you touch it, and made-to-order wooden frames to load them on. As an example, when they wanted to move a giraffe within the museum, upstairs to downstairs, it took them 4 months. And then when everything gets to Reading, everything will be frozen for 3 days and then transferred into these pristine, sanitised rooms. So I asked Claire how long she expects the whole process to take.
So we're assuming that we will finish by the end of 2030.
Yeah. Because it's such a long process, she expects it's going to take several years at least.
And Caitlin, are any other museums doing this?
Yeah, so there's actually a trend at the moment to move things out of storage. I think, especially in Britain, it's reached a point where the buildings just aren't fit for purpose anymore. And that's why we're finding lots of museums are moving. So the British Museum has already shifted some of its large sculptures and mosaics to a new centre in Reading. The Victoria and Albert Museum, the Science Museum and Oxford University's 4 museums, including the Ashmolean Museum of Art, are also ferrying objects to new buildings, bespoke buildings that are going to be better for their collections. And it's not just Britain. In France, curators at the National Museum of Natural History in Paris aren't too happy about a planned move to Dijon because the collections will be so far from the museum that it will be really hard for them to carry on researching the collections. And then across the pond in America, the MIT Museum is in the final stages of shifting 1.5 million objects. Moving millions of objects safely is very hard, but it does offer a chance to rediscover, reassess, and reorganise collections.
Tell me a bit more about that.
So in terms of rediscovering objects, it's easier than you'd think for things to go missing. So last year there was a big scandal in Britain when it was revealed that a light-fingered curator had stolen up to 2,000 objects from the British Museum and sold some of them on eBay. And this was a scandal for the museum, but the idea that they might have not noticed that some small objects were missing is actually alarmingly common. Many museums don't know exactly what they've got. They have a broad idea, but they might not have everything catalogued properly, or the catalogues might be on paper and they haven't digitised them, that kind of thing. And with current staff, the Natural History Museum reckons it would take 172 years to catalogue everything properly. But Claire told me that a new team has been hired for the move and they'll create a detailed database of the 28 million objects that are moving. So it will speed up that process a little bit.
You know, who collected it? Who identified it? Where's it from? When was it collected and how was it?
So modern buildings will reduce staff to-do lists in other ways too, because checking objects for damage and that they haven't been infested by bugs, it takes a lot of time, and the worse the buildings are, the more you have to check things.
We make sure that the temperature, relative humidity and the lighting levels are all in appropriate parameters.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I think that's, yeah, that's
great.
Everything.
Thank you so much.
So the Natural History Museum's plan to get treasures to safer ground should protect their displays and make sure that they can keep doing their job as a custodian of knowledge and natural history objects well into the future.
Caitlin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Aure.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. As usual, you can let us know what you think of the show by emailing us at podcasts@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
With the highest number of young STEM graduates per capita in the EU, Ireland has the people and skills your company needs to succeed here. IDA Ireland, the National Investment Development Agency, can help you find and nurture the people you need to internationalise and thrive. Our talent is just one of the extraordinary benefits Ireland has to offer. Learn more at idaireland.com. Invest in extraordinary.